This episode of HPC Wire Soundbite is sponsored by ISC 13, the global HPC conference for driving innovation, information, and discussion about high-performance computing, networking, storage, and more. Join the HPC community from June 16th through the 20th in Leipzig, Germany. www.isc13.org.
This is HPC Wire Soundbite, your weekly source of commentary and insight on the HPC stories shaping the industry.
Horst Simon says,
and Google and NASA take a quantum leap.
Hello and welcome to HPC Wire Soundbite for May 17th, 2013, available every Friday on iTunes and Stitcher. I'm Addison Snell with Intersect 360 Research, joined again by Nicole Hemsoth, editor of HPC Wire. Hey, how you doing, Nicole?
Pretty good. How about you, Addison?
Good. Another week in the news and more people talking about exascale, but this time really interesting to me because we've got one of the original authors of the top 500 list, Horst Simon, weighing in on what he thinks about exascale.
That's right. So Horst Simon, who's now the deputy director at Lawrence Berkeley National Lab, is one of the four authors of the top 500. And he made a presentation, gave it back-to-back earlier this month called No Exascale for You. Seinfeld reference
little,
there.
Yeah. And dropping in the Seinfeld, so we got the exascale, no exascale for you. That's great.
That's right. So, I mean, this got a lot of attention, not just because of the rather snappy referential title, but, you know, here's one of these guys that's always been, I think, to some degree, very supportive of a flops-centric set of benchmarks, saying that this just isn't sustainable. So, you know, he did a Q&A with HPC Wire this week, which was so kindly submitted by John Bashore at Berkeley. But he made the point that the methods that we're using right now to predict when we're going to cross certain thresholds, like teraflops, petaflops, no longer apply, period. And he gave a sense of like three separate swim lanes. And so I don't know, did you take a look at that article, Addison? Did you see the three swim lanes that he identified, multi-core? And
I did. Great interview. And he's essentially talking about the different architectural approaches that we could take to reach an exascale level machine. And this gets back to the processor architecture wars that we've covered thoroughly on this podcast going back for the last year and a half, looking at, you don't know what the dominant architecture is that's going to win out, whether it's just more x86 processors or whether you go to something like the power architecture and what you see in BlueJeans, or you go with the GPU computing or something that used to be a GPU with in the case of Larrabee morphing into Intel Xeon Phi. And then, you know, you've still got Spark systems up there with Fujitsu and K. So it's you know, you can start, he categorizes them into three main architectural approaches. But his point that you don't know which of these to bet on right now is spot on.
Right. You mentioned the Spark, by the way, and just to go back to last week's podcast, speaking of exascale and Spark, it could very well be Japan, like you mentioned last week. But, you know, Horst Simon is saying that he's placing a bet, like literally and figuratively, that by 2015, all of the top 10 systems, the top 500 list, are going to be GPU or accelerator-based, coprocessor-based. So pretty bold prediction, and it was backed up this week, too, on a Slashdot article where Bill Kramer from NCSA echoed a lot of these same sentiments and talked about the need to reconsider the value of WinPack.
Yes, well, absolutely, and we did just see that Slashdot article where Bill Kramer is suggesting that we need an alternative to the top 500 list because it's putting the emphasis on the wrong things. He reasons that LINPACK doesn't accurately reflect real load workflows for the majority of supercomputers, and therefore the top 500 list is causing us to invest in the wrong things. Now, if you combine that with Horst's message that we're going to be dominated by GPU technologies, the implication would be that, you know, if both those statements are true, that Bill would think that that's the wrong architectural direction.
So, you know, I'm going to point back to the Horst Simon article, and I really like this quote from him. He said, "You could say that the end of the HPC world as we know it began in 2004 when we hit the inflection point of power use and clock speed. That's when we realized that we couldn't keep increasing clock speed due to power demands and heat, but needed to move to much greater parallelism. So we've got the compounding forces of brand new, very striking architectures, plus, of course, Moore's Law, plus, of course, kind of the changing competitive and even funding landscape for exascale coming up. So nothing can stay the same here. It seems like there's deadlock in some senses.
Right. Well, and as always, it comes down to what do you want your supercomputer to do? And, you know, Bill Kramer's point that LINPACK doesn't accurately reflect the majority of supercomputing workloads, I think, is accurate. However, LINPACK has this going for it in that it's simple. The top 500 list just ranks the computers according to LINPACK, and you have to concede that there are some applications for which large matrix multiplication is a nice proxy for how well it might perform. There are parallel applications out there that are like this. Blue Waters and the workload that it has there, top 500 and LINPACK are not a good reflection of what that supercomputer is trying to do. Now, the question would then become, okay, if you don't like top 500 or LINPACK, what else do you like? And unless something else is as simple as here's the score, here's the ranking, it's just not going to catch on in the same way. We're going to run these 12 benchmarks and do some kind of composite ranking. You've got to get everyone to buy in, and it's got to be simple.
Yeah, I can only imagine how long something like that would take to get consensus on some sort of composite benchmark. But, you know, obviously June list, which is about this time next month, it'll be coming out. November, I can't see any change then. I don't know how quickly you could even possibly push forward something that's been so entrenched for over 20 years.
I don't think you wind up getting rid of top 500. I like top 500 for what it represents. I agree that we need to have more intelligence about what constitutes a powerful supercomputer. The metaphor I carry around in my head about it is, you know, there's a lot more ways to tell whether a food is good for you than how many calories it has. But people still look at counting calories as a metric of, is this food good for me or not? And then other metrics that eventually catch on in various degrees have to be as simple. How many grams of fat? How many carbs? How many Weight Watchers points? And each of these is not in itself a sufficient way to determine how healthy a food is. But the more complicated it gets, the harder it is to count. And that's kind of where we are with supercomputing rankings. You can look at how many flops. You can look at the LINPACK score. You can look at what its I.O., how many gigabytes per second it can do in I.O. You can look at its bisection bandwidth. But then the more complicated it gets, the fewer people are going to look at that metric.
I definitely get what you're saying. I'm also surprised that you count Weight Watchers points, Addison, but another conversation entirely. You know,
they have Weight Watchers for men now.
I see. Well, anyway, another time. this show brought to you.
You know, because the men need manly points for their diets. They can't just use the women's points. They have to have a whole different scale. But getting back to the exaflop discussion, the other half of what he said is that we didn't think we're going to have exascale by 2020. I think, you know, there's implicit in that a linkage between exaflop and exascale. There's maybe an implicit agreement about what do we mean when we say exascale. Does that mean sustained exaflop on some relevant benchmark or application? That probably needs to be called out somewhere. If you're moving an exabyte of data, does that mean exascale? Exa-what? You know, that should probably be part of the discussion somewhere, but nevertheless interesting in terms of what it implies for system architectures.
Oddly enough, you know, I do an awful lot of reading for this job about exascale and other things, and I don't think I've ever...
That's your job.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think I've ever seen that clearly stated, and that's a wonderful point. I mean, maybe around ISC this year, I'll try to gather some quotes from some of our people to watch this year about, you know, what exactly does exascale for you imply when used in the general sense, when people are having conversations. So we will boil that also down maybe to something a little simpler.
I'll go ahead, though, and place a bet. I think we will have at least an exaflop machine on some metric by 2020. I don't think it'll be in the U.S. anymore. I think Japan beats us there, and there's a fair chance China might beat us as well.
So you mean exa-what, Addison?
Well, exa-what, right? There will be any number of people who will dismiss it as a trick system that's designed to do an exaflop on LINPACK, and then we'll get into the same arguments about, you know, is that an efficient system, and what kind of software work do we need to do? What kind of power work do we need to do? It's all songs that we've heard before, but it'll be the dawn of the exascale era.
ISC brings together the global HPC community in Leipzig this June to share and discuss the latest in HPC technologies and applications. This year's event will feature four compelling keynotes: the brand new industry track, distinguished speaker series, HPC applications, HPC challenges, big data, and more. ISC 13 also offers 5 days to network with 2,500 like-minded researchers, scientists, and vendors. The conference is an ideal opportunity to help shape collaborations and build new strategic partnerships. Over 170 leading service and solution providers, as well as research organizations, will also showcase their newest technologies and research. Visit www.isc13.org for the full agenda.
Speaking of trick systems and kind of questionable ways of doing things. Now, I don't mean to throw it into a skeptic's light, but I know that there are skeptics out there. We've had a lot of news around quantum computing lately, and it is actually very fascinating stuff scientifically and theoretically. D-Wave is the only company, the first company to make a system and actually sell one. So they had one in operation at Lockheed Martin, at the USC Lockheed Martin Quantum Computing Center. And it was a theoretical system. Lockheed did have a couple of applications running on it. They only work for a certain type of application. So machine learning, AI, and Google and NASA joined together. This was announced today to announce they bought a D-Wave 2 system to work on quantum applications, which take from what Bo Ewald, now the president of D-Wave, who we talked to this week, he said it takes, some serious PhD mathematicians and physicists to be able to write programs for these. But
yeah, we reported briefly last week that Bo had joined D-Wave. I think this is extremely relevant to our previous conversation, Nicole, or the part leading into the first half of the podcast, with different architectures for different types of applications. A quantum computer is, LINPACK is not going to be a good metric for whether this is effective. And as you pointed out, this generation of D-Wave 2 is a specialized machine for particular applications, but we do see NASA, Google, the University Space Research Association investing in this 512 qubit machine to start working on these specialized applications. I would like to get another full briefing on it. I don't believe this generation is doing entanglement yet as part of the computation, although I'd be delighted to be proven wrong and will retract my statement later if I'm wrong. But when we get to the entanglement, I think we're also looking ahead to other types of applications in encrypt analysis and potentially also certain types of analytics.
Yeah, I do actually believe that they have managed, now this is based on my conversation with Bo Ewald, they've managed to create the conditions for entanglement within this cryogenic cabinet. So there's actually a pretty good image and feature that I wrote this week that shows this very beautiful, actually, kind of copper-looking system, the inside of it. Supposedly, they create all the conditions. So you obviously need to have no vibration, zero magnetism, temperature as close as you can get to absolute zero. It sounds impossible to me, especially if you're going to set one of these down in California where the Earth is moving all the time. How do you create vibration-free?
Right.
This is fascinating stuff, and we're going to have to wait and see what kind of benchmarks roll out. There is one researcher, and I pointed to a paper that she just presented at an IEEE conference that actually benchmarked where quantum systems perform well. And, you know, what she said and what Bo Ewald are saying are the same thing, that the benchmarks are so it can process certain types of problems so quickly that the benchmarks are almost meaningless compared to what's possible. Now, we're talking nearly instantaneous computation, if you can imagine that or believe it.
Well, but that gets into a relative question of what is a length of time that is nearly instantaneous. It's like, what's an amount of storage that's nearly infinite, which is the opposite side of the math equation that we often hear. But I take your point about quantum. It's the sort of topic that I need to brush up on my physics before I have any kind of meeting or briefing on it, trying to remind myself what the Heisenberg uncertainty principle means and how it relates to computing. But it's always a fun challenge, and I'm glad to see that D-Wave is moving on to this next generation. And as I said, I'm going to look forward to getting a new briefing from D-Wave. We haven't spoken with them in a while. They've been mostly secret behind the scenes. But with Bo there now, some of this news coming out, I'm looking forward to talking to them again.
Well, I mean, this company, by the way, this isn't some startup, obviously. They've been working on these
problems. No, they've been around for years, yeah.
Since 1999, and they've got, if you take a look at some of the financial backing for D-Wave, it's pretty impressive. I mean, everyone from Goldman Sachs and on, I mean, pretty household names. So this promises, I think, to be one of, well, if I can throw an opinion out there, one of the bigger stories of the coming 10 years. In terms of who's able to step up with the right funding, science, and talent to compete with D-Wave, who's going to actually buy the systems. I mean.
Well, you know, there's an aphorism that I like where if you're trying to look for what's going to be the next big thing, look for what was supposed to be the next big thing 15 years ago, but it was too early, right? And that's certainly the case with quantum computing. If you go back to the late 90s, and the HPCS program was kicking off at DARPA, the whole point of HPCS, which was written right into the mission statement, you can go back and look it up, was to design new generations of highly productive systems in order to bridge the gap until we reached the promise of quantum computing, which they were expecting, you know, to be coming in sometime this decade. And here we are, and you know, we've got D-Wave still out there swinging away, and now got NASA and Google on board, kicking the tires, as it were.
Yeah, just before we wrap up here, I got to say one of the more interesting quotes I got from Bo Ewald was how, of course, this is early stages, and he talked about how this kind of parallels with what happened with GPUs. We were talking a little bit about the obviously very limited software environment that they have for quantum computers. But he said, you know, at the beginning, GPUs were very much the same thing. I mean, they were this kind of fringe technology where only certain people were sort of bothering to build out the ecosystem. And, you know, a relatively short time later, there was enough interest and promise there that, you know, the people that had money at stake and you know, research projects at stake stepped up and created that pretty amazing ecosystem that's now the GPU computing space.
Well, it's the sort of thing that takes investment, and if I can pick my favorite quote of the week, I'll go back to your interview with Horst Simon, where towards the end of the interview he said, the U.S. is not the only country capable of achieving exascale computing, but just like the Chinese emperor in the 15th century, Congress has stopped us now with insufficient funding to move ahead and explore the new frontiers of computing. So there you have it, right from Horst, in terms of what he thinks is the investment challenge with U.S. and exascale.
Well, that is an epic quote. I will say that much.
Well, we're as you said, ramping up to ISC. We've got the new top 500 list coming next month. We'll see what the architectural moves are on that. But there's a lot more development in this for the next decade.
That's right. And both of us will be at ISC, I imagine. We will be doing a podcast from there, too. So.
Oh, at least one, and probably more than one.
Oh, I'm looking forward to it.
Excellent. I'll talk to you again next week, Nicole.
Bye, Ed.
This episode of HPC Wire Soundbite has been sponsored by ISC 13, the 28th International Supercomputing Conference. Come and join 2,500 members of the HPC community from June 16th to the 20th in Leipzig, Germany. Visit www.isc13.org.
You've been listening to HPC Wire Soundbite. Got a question or comment? Email soundbite@hpcwire.com. HPC Wire Soundbite is available every Friday afternoon from iTunes or at hpcwire.com. HPC Wire, the leading source for global news and information covering the ecosystem of high productivity computing.